Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table, where we discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. And I have two very distinguished guests with me today. Through the miracle of technology, we're talking to Ahmad Shahada, who is in Jordan. That's not Jordan, Texas, or Jordan, Georgia, okay? That's the country of Jordan, where he is. He's already experienced most of the day. And then Andy Seidel is with us, formerly Executive Director for Christian Leadership at Dallas Theological Seminary. And now you are?
I am a adjunct professor working in extension sites for DTS.
There you go. And you formerly taught at the Military Academy, is that right?
I did. I taught mathematics at West Point for 4 years.
Okay, very good. And Ahmad, give us your official title.
Okay, I'm the president of Jordan Evangelical Theological Seminary, and I'm a professor of theology there.
That's right. And he's also a distinguished member of the board here at Dallas Seminary. Right. So we get to see Ahmad a couple of times a year when he journeys back over and touches base with us. Well, thank you both for being here. Our topic today, because those introductions gave you no clue as to what we were going to discuss.
It's mathematics.
That's right. Has to do with the issue of war, peace in the Middle East, and kind of where we are, both thinking about that both in biblical terms as well as also kind of what the status of things is in the Middle East and what it's like to be living in the Middle East these days. And so I want to thank you all for taking the time to come in and talk with us about this. Andy, I'm going to start off with you. You came to the seminary with a career out of the military, and some people would say, well, How do the military and Christianity mix? You know, how do you put war and peace together? How do you view that? And I can't think of a better person to ask than someone who's spent their life both as a pastor and in the military this question. So how do you put that together? How do you deal when you come to the issue of war and peace and you think about that biblically and you think about your full career in the military? How do you put those two things together?
Well, I think for me, it was a relatively easy thing because when I went into the military, I went out of high school, I went to West Point, and the values of the military, Christianity was very much a part of that. A lot of my spiritual growth came as a result of other members of the military who discipled me and helped me. Part of the Officers Christian Fellowship, and you know, it was a very significant thing spiritually. So the two of them were not spiritually separated at all. There was no divorce there. And so a lot of the values of service and of protection of the weak, things like that, all of those were good military values, and they were good Christian values as well. Respect for people. And so I learned a lot of that strongly in my early part of the military career.
Interesting. Well, you know, because what a lot of people will assume is that we have the military. I'm gonna state it this way and let you react, and you can push back if you want. We have the military really to protect us on the one hand, but also you know, to fight our battles for us, you know, to go to war. But my take is, from having interacted with military people over the years, is that the military really sees itself as existing in part enabling us to keep the peace as opposed to more doing war. Would that be a fair way to think about the way the military sees itself?
Yeah, I would say that's true. You don't see in American military, you don't see the aggressive, let's take over someplace. And it's more of a protection. You know, my military experience, my first was in Korea. This was post-Korean War, but I was on the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. And so it was a matter of protection, a matter of protecting South Korea. You also always have to say protecting American interests. Mm-hmm. That's true. Every country does that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not seen it as in a negative sense mm-hmm. of taking over someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it has been essentially a good experience through uh-huh. that.
Okay.
And one that I could feel comfortable with as a Christian.
So, you know, the scripture, of course, speaks of the military in Romans 13 as having the power of the sword, which is an element of protection
right.
of its people
right.
and that kind of thing. So there's biblical basis for that. And the idea of nations having interests that they have to protect is something to a certain degree scripture assumes. So I'm laying this groundwork because I think it's important in thinking about issues where, we live in a fallen world. There is conflict.
That's right.
People treat each other badly, and there's protection and that is sometimes necessary at a corporate or national level in terms of interests. Well, I'm doing some prolegomena here, so let me shift to another topic that I think is important, and that is the idea of just war. That in the background really, even Christian thinking about conflict, there has been mm-hmm. a teaching and an idea which many nations embrace, particularly in the West, at least theoretically, that there is such a concept as just war. Just war comes out of a Christian tradition. I think it's rooted mm-hmm. in the teachings of Augustine and others. And most people have probably heard the phrase, but they don't know what's involved in it. And I have a list here of things, and I just want you to kind of comment on them. I could have given you an exam and said,
yeah.
you know, list the various
right.
features
right.
of just
okay.
war.
But thank you for not doing that.
But
I think one of the main reasons is you go to war for a just reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for a selfish reason, that kind of thing, where you're going to enslave somebody else for your own benefit, something mm-hmm. like that. But there's the reason you go. It's got to be just.
Yeah, in fact, that's point one. The war must have a just cause and be fundamentally what we might call a defensive war. It is for protection. It is to protect certain interests, that kind of thing, that are at risk or at threat because of some form of aggression or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's protective in that kind of way. That's the first category. A second category is it must have a just intention to secure a fair peace for all parties. So that excludes things like national revenge, economic exploitation,
right.
or ethnic cleansing
right.
for those kinds of reasons. It must be a last resort that all diplomatic efforts, or at least sustained diplomatic efforts have been pursued and may even continue while the war is being pursued, because the goal is not to continue to fight but to get to a resolution and get back to a state of peace. A fourth one is, although I think this has become cloudier in the modern world, in the more modern world, properly constituted authorities declare it, and the war is to be the work of states.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that's changed.
Yeah, that has changed dramatically
mm-hmm.
because you have Al-Qaeda, things like that. They are not states,
mm-hmm.
and they are going to war, and other countries are going to having to come and have conflict with them, and they're not under the same rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some of these, as I said, the roots of this go back to Augustine. We're talking about a different time, a different place when there were different realities. But this is generally the way the doctrine of just war has been stated. It must have limited objectives. In other words, the goal is not the annihilation of the enemy, but really sustain an effort to prosecute a war that has the limited objectives of providing the protection and providing the security or securing the kinds of just interests that the war is pursuing. It has to use proportionate means sufficient to deter the aggression. And this is another place where the ancient doctrine and the modern discussion run into kind of each other, because with the rise of nuclear weapons and the potential of total destruction, the issue of proportionality becomes a pretty important concept to wrestle with.
Yes.
And then seventh, it must respect non-combatant immunity as much as possible, including wounded soldiers or prisoners of war. Weapons of indiscriminate mass destruction are considered immoral. And in the concept of just war. So you don't just, you know, obliterate, theoretically, you don't just go in and obliterate a city or something like that. Again, one of the, comparing the ancient teaching to the modern situation, that's one of the things that made America's use of the nuclear bomb in Japan controversial, was because in the effort to quickly end the war with a devastating act, a lot of civilians were killed. And so,
but you can't stop there.
Yeah.
Because that decision was made toward the end of World War II, obviously.
Mm-hmm, right.
And one of the things that really impacted the U.S. decision was the Battle of Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Okinawa, that was a Japanese island.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't one that they just occupied. That was part of their nation.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in the Battle of Okinawa is that Japanese citizens on that island, not just Japanese military, the military did suicide charges. Some of the civilians joined in with that, but that's also the place where all the civilians that, you remember, they jumped off the cliff into the ocean, committed suicide.
Hmm.
That is also the place where you had the kamikazes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time kamikazes really became prevalent.
Hmm.
And the interesting thing, there's a really interesting book on that, Ripples of Battles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the impact of various battles on the future and how we fight battles today. Well, one of the things with the kamikazes, they did not sink any significant ship, no aircraft carriers. They sunk mostly destroyers and stuff like that. But what happened is that it communicated that they are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, give up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, would Japan surrender, even though we're getting closer and closer and closer and we're bombing them, things like that. And they also had radio intercepts of what was going on in Japan that they were arming the civilians and everybody was going to fight till
the death. So it isn't as neutral as it looks, is what
you're saying. No, it's
not. Yeah.
And so what the Americans faced is if we have to invade Japan, you think about the cost of invading those smaller islands.
Right.
If we have to invade Japan, it's going to cost, the estimate was at least 1 million American lives, and who knows
countless
how many Japanese lives.
Yeah.
So they have that decision. So what they do is they decide to use the nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exactly all of the things that they did, but they gave some warning to it. And they dropped it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they dropped the second one. And then the Japanese indicated that they were going to surrender. Now, some of the controversy is, did they really need to drop the second one?
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't really speak to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that caused a lot of devastation. But, you know, you can firebomb cities.
Mm-hmm.
Even go back to the ancient world, you set fire to cities, and they weren't all as.
Yeah.
They didn't have the fire people that we do today.
Right.
So, you know, there's a quantitative jump. That's right.
Yeah.
But it's a similar thing.
Yeah. Well, the reason you go through this and think about it is that most people don't even think about it. They just think there's war or peace. You know, they don't think about the fact that there are actually people who really do wrestle with these kinds of decisions in very serious kinds of ways in terms of the consequences that are dealt with. Well, those are most of the elements that feed into a just war situation. Now, why paint a picture of war and conflict? Well, that's because in certain parts of the world, obviously, we are engaged in conflict, and places are full of tension, and probably no place is as much like that, Ahmad, as the Middle East. Why don't you tell people your own personal background a little bit so they kind of see where you fit into the Middle East story personally, and then they'll have some sense of what perspective you're speaking out of, and then tell us a little bit about what it's like to live in Jordan these days with what's going on around you.
Okay. Well, my personal background is I'm an Palestinian Arab originally. I came to college to the U.S. in the early 70s, and I became a Christian there at University of California, San Diego. and years later became a full-time ministry, and then went to Dallas Seminary, and there was a lot of jokes about a Palestinian being at a dispensational school.
Yeah, well, I thought the church and Israel were completely distinct, and I guess that maybe that's true.
Oh, yeah. Lots of stories on that. Uh-huh. Appreciate my Dallas experience, just to put the scripture first and my background second, and that gave me so many tools in the present ministry we have with the seminary. And establishing the seminary about 25 years ago in Amman, Jordan, and the and of course it's not easy. It's been a rough road, and it's been one of the challenges is when even before all the tensions that we are presently having, even teaching at the seminary, men and women who come from these Arab countries who hate Israel, and then you have to teach eschatology and to show them from the scriptures how to see the grace of God and the faithfulness of God to His word, to His covenants, and so forth, and to try to give a balance. And it's been a good experience in seeing how teaching eschatology has been a means to communicate grace to all these different people. You have Palestinians, Iraqis, Syrians, Egyptians who have Christians, believers who have been just not had the exposure to think about these issues and see how so much of their thinking has been affected by the majority religion rather than by scripture. Mm-hmm. And so forth. So that's been a good experience. And of course there's so much to talk about, but obviously we have to cut short. But coming to what we are going through right now in the Middle East, it's unprecedented in several ways. Excuse me, several ways. Excuse me for my little bit of a cold here, mm-hmm. but in several ways, you have it's the Middle East is so divided right now politically, so that it's just. So many groups are against each other, and it's like the enemy of my enemy is my enemy, and that's all over the place. And there have been some unprecedented people who have been traditionally opposing each other standing on the same side together, let's say against one extremist group. Nations that normally don't stand together are standing together, and so forth. And I'm limited in what I can say, but this is happening.
Let me see if I can give a little bit of context for people, because most people just know there's conflict in the Middle East and that kind of thing, but they don't know some of the history that goes behind this. And I'm hoping, Ahmad, that you can help us a little bit with this so that people kind of understand where some of the tensions were. And I'm going to take us back to the beginning of the 20th century when the Ottoman Empire basically broke up. And nations were created out of that residue. And really, in many ways, some of the problems that exist because of the way those boundaries were drawn. Is that a fair starting point for some of what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's true. And if you look at the map geographically, you wonder how these territories, how these borders came to be. And it was basically you have the French protectorates, what they called, and the British protectorates. So Jordan and Saudi Arabia, maybe Israel, were under the British. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And so was Iraq, but Syria and Lebanon were under the French. And so there's that background there. So yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And so it's put together combinations of people into nations that were to some degree. I'm going to be trying to be descriptive here so people will get it. Artificially created into a nation, and you had mixtures of people who struggled to get along. Fair enough?
Yes, that's true, exactly.
And these produced regional pressures within these. I mean, you don't even have to put Israel in the mix, because we're talking about a time when Israel as a nation didn't exist, of course. And you had this mix of countries with the different with the different parties within Islam. You know, a lot of people don't even know that there are different parties within Islam, trying to exist side by side, and they had tensions with each other.
Yes.
And so that's part of the reality, right?
Yes. Now, the majority of the Arabic-speaking world would be the Sunni Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Iraq, the majority of Iraq would be Shiite Islam, but mm-hmm. that's on the eastern side of the Arab countries,
mm-hmm.
and Iraq would be on the towards is a neighbor of Iran, which is mostly Shiite. So now the tension is we've got with Iran's penetration into dominating Syria and having the Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon. So we have Shiite penetration into Syria and Lebanon, and then recently in Yemen. So there's this going on, and Sunni Muslims don't like that, and so they're reacting to this. While also there's a tension between Sunnis and Sunnis, represented by the tension between ISIS and the moderate Sunni states. So that's given more tension to the situation. And then you have Israel siding with some of the Sunni states against another Sunni extremist group, while the Shiites are on the side of some of the Sunnis in Iraq to fight the same Shiite group. And it's really complicated.
Yeah, it sounds like, in fact, we don't have a visual. We might need one to map out with colors what's going on here. But I actually think this is important, because part of what it says to people is that when you say the word Islam, you're actually dealing with huge amount of people that we're talking about in the region, but they aren't all. It's not one block. It's not one thing. Mm. There are different expressions of Islam, with different mixtures of if I can, I'm going to say it this way. It may not be the best description, but of peace or violence mixed into it, which then produces combustible elements within these countries. And as I said, we've hardly said a word about Israel yet in any of this.
And so I
think that's an important part of the picture, that it's important that people get. Now, you add to that mix, coming in, you know, with the founding of Israel in the 1940s, you add that into the mix, mm. and the Arab reaction and Palestinian reaction that came with the establishment of the nation of Israel in this area, and all that did was add fuel to the to the smoldering fire.
Right, exactly. Now, most of Islam is Sunni Islam, 90%. Right.
Uh-huh.
Shiite Muslim Islam would be the minority.
Uh-huh.
And most of the Arab countries, that's 22 countries from Morocco all the way to Iraq, Morocco in Africa, all the way to Iraq would be Sunni Muslim. So Iraq would be the only Arab country that's majority people are Shiite.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you have.
What if you were to help people kind of summarize the difference between Sunni and Shiite? What would that is there a way to summarize what that difference would be?
Well, it's a difference in what actually happened in history and what the Shiites wish happened, but did not happen.
Okay.
So traditionally establishment of the caliphates, or those caliphs that took over after Muhammad died, was one thing, and Shiites feel it should have been a different line rather than the,
this is a prophetic line that you're talking about, or
yeah.
what you used a technical term here that wasn't English, so I'm asking you to translate it for
it's
us.
Family line, wasn't
oh
it?
Yeah,
it,
family
that's
line.
That's Islamic thinking.
Uh-huh.
The Rashid family, the Rashid Caliphate, took over after Muhammad.
Okay.
For reasons that nobody fully knows for sure, where the Shiites feel it should not have been given that way, and then with history, there's been differences in their beliefs a little bit. They still believe in Muhammad and the Quran as the same book, but they feel that the authority or the Khalith that should belongs to the Shiite understanding and not to the traditional classical understanding.
So this is a family feud in its roots.
In terms,
Interesting. Okay, Andy. So you look at this and from the outside as American, someone who's also been involved in the military, and what do you see going on as you think about the chaos of whether we're thinking about it from the historical point of view or kind of where we are now? How's that for an open-ended question?
No, it's so similar to so many things. Some of it has to do with bad government, just, bad government. And, one group oppressing another group or one group keeping another group down, one group favoring its own, Saddam Hussein was like that. But most of the rulers tend to be like that. And so if there's some reason to discriminate against another group, they'll do that. And so you have just boiling up of all of these tensions. And as Ahmad said, that's a huge group of people. And they have all kinds of historical and current reasons to be, upset with each other. And so, originally, as I was thinking about it, it's sad that here you have a tribal group, but, some of them are against each other, too. And so now you have one group that for a particular religious view is oppressing, so many of them. So ISIS is basically a Sunni group, if I understand correctly. I'm sorry, a Shia group, if I understand correctly, or Sunni. And what happens is now they're oppressing Sunnis as well as Shias. And so it's been like that through the years, I'm sure.
And Jordan occupies an unusual position in all of this as a country. Is that not true? It seems of most of the Arab countries, perhaps Egypt is in a similar category, to have managed being a part of this mix relatively well, and been one of the more stable countries in the region. But it's feeling pressure now too, isn't it?
Yes and no. It's interesting what's happening. Of course, Jordan, as you know, has the longest border with Israel.
Right.
Israel is to the west of it, and Iraq to the east. You've got Syria to the north, and that pressure of refugees coming into Jordan, and then Saudi to the south. And like you've maybe heard it said, Jordan is between Iraq and a hard place. But it's amazing; has been amazingly stable. It's interesting. But some of the analysis has been that actually Jordan is now more stable. One main reason is because when Israel became a state, so many Palestinians immigrated to Jordan, and majority of the Jordanian population is, till this day, has been Palestinian and not Jordanian. And so it's been a polarity, Jordanian-Palestinian. But now, with so many refugees from Iraq and Syria, it's changed. So now the minority group is no longer a minority. It's more equal. There's more groups, and they're more equal now. That gave Jordan more stability, and the government of Jordan is looking to give the Jordanian citizenship to the Iraqis and to the Syrians, and they're finding better jobs, better life, and they want to stay in Jordan. So Jordan is actually, in a way, stronger, though there's been this this amazing pressure. Actually, in the last 20 years, Jordan's population more than doubled that way. And so it's interesting. So Jordan typically has been kind of a country of refuge for so many people. The Lebanese before that, began with the Palestinians, then the Lebanese and the Iraqis, and a lot of Libyans came in, a lot of Syrians now coming in. And it's given Jordan it's sort of a picture of being, let's keep this country, at least keep a country where we can go to. And although it looks like it could be next, but by God's grace, it's been so far stable this way. So we're thankful for that. And one amazing byproduct that was not planned by ISIS or anybody is we have more students from these refugees. They come in from these countries and they come and become students at the seminary. And it's just amazing. God's way of preparing people for these countries to go back and serve and, you know, being more equipped. And so we would love it. It's great. We just need more scholarship funds for these.
Wow.
That's terrific.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I know a little bit about the history of the seminary, and it was interesting. There was a time in which you were educating people literally from all over the Arab world, and then things got tightened down a little bit, and so that became harder. And now there's a new form of recruitment that's emerged through these circumstances.
God
bringing them into the country, and therefore they have access again to the education. Well, we aren't going to solve the Middle East crisis in this podcast, so I'm not even going to try. But I did want some background for what we were going to discuss in place so that people can understand the confusing thing. Because I think, and now I'm speaking particularly to Americans who are listening to this, I think sometimes Americans go, first of all, we're kind of slow to get our hands around what goes on in different parts of the world. And particularly when it comes to Islam, we tend to think of Islam as one singular thing. We don't realize the differences that exist within Islam, the tensions that exist amongst Muslims, and how that is a part of what's going on here that makes this such a difficult reality to deal with. I do have one more question for you, Andy, that's kind of a background question, and then I'm gonna switch over and begin to ask the question. So how do Christians function in the midst of this? And that's this. When someone like you who's in the when you're in the military and you go into this, the military really makes quite an effort to make sure people have a sense of this history and these tensions and where they're coming from. Don't they do some preparation for people who are, you know, going to be stationed in these locations to give them a sense of what it is they're walking into in terms of the cultural background and realities of what they're facing?
Oh, yeah, they try to do that, uh-huh. Especially post-World War II. Mm-hmm. They've had to do that. Vietnam, they did considerable instruction of us, partly about the people, but recognizing the insurgent aspect of the war.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very strict on how we related to the people,
mm-hmm.
and respected them. And so, yes, they do. They try to do that. Problem is, sometimes you get caught and you're coming from behind and trying to catch up on uh-huh. what we know. So, just like now, we find ourselves supporting the same thing that Iran is supporting in one case and being against it in another case. And it's very complicated in that situation.
Huh. And so can you fill that out a little bit in terms of what we're looking at? So depending on where we are in the region and the nature of the regional conflict, we are in some cases supporting and in other cases against. Is that
yes.
where we find
yes.
ourselves?
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's very, very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have, you also, this is a new day because the media is there.
Mm-hmm.
The media is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that you relate to people from the country, whether they are friends or enemies, is very, very significant because it's
reported immediately.
It's reported immediately.
Yeah.
We went to a huge amount, as we understood the counterinsurgency issues in Vietnam, not to have casualties among civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Because it might make, first of all, they didn't need that because
yeah.
they were not against us. But secondly, it might cause them to go to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets to be very complicated. So something happens, you've got a media person right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's even more so now in the Middle East, some of the wars in Israel, you know, there's media on both sides of the battles. And I you know, have seen a number of times that is used by one side or the other to say, oh, look, you're killing civilians and this kind of thing. And so it gets to be very, very difficult. And I think the U.S. works very hard to try to educate its soldiers and about the issues that are going on in the country so that they can relate to the civilians well. Because in the counterinsurgency things, the enemy hides among the civilians. Hmm. Now, with ISIS, that's a little different.
Hmm.
Because they have changed the situation. The insurgents, they weren't trying to hold on to territory or something. They were just trying to fight and kill their enemy, which in Iraq was us. Now ISIS is, they're going to have a caliphate and all of that. They have to have territory. So this is, interestingly, taking kind of a step back mm-hmm. to a situation where you are, and they are saying that they are a nation now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Al-Qaeda didn't do that. Mm-hmm. They were just a terrorist organization mm-hmm. and others like that. And so for them, it wasn't a matter of conquering territory and holding that territory. With ISIS, it is.
Hmm.
Because if they can't hold the territory, they're not a nation.
Hmm.
So we're in a very complicated situation.
Thanks for listening to the Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Join us next week for part two. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.